This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Rithula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. And this week, coronavirus, the economic crisis. For the first time in modern history, the world en masse is closing down.
Stock markets have fallen sharply again.
You're being told not to go out.
Pretty much all my friends in the business have already closed or are closing.
We made a decision to lay off our entire hourly team.
Airlines announcing that they're cutting flights.
People are being urged not to use public transport.
Euro 2020 became the latest sports event to fall.
Cancelling the festival was really the only viable option.
It's like a perfect storm here in Ukraine. We face both the plague and war.
The hit could be as much as 25 million jobs worldwide.
The brakes are being slammed on economic activity in a desperate bid to beat back a virus that's already taken around 9,000 lives and infected more than 200,000 people around the globe. Sporting events, concerts, conferences, everything is being postponed or abandoned. Job losses are inevitable. Stock markets have plunged, economies are shrinking dramatically, and governments are proposing multi-billion dollar emergency support programs. This is a health crisis with grave economic consequences for all of us. So how should governments, businesses and workers act in the face of a threat which we still know little about? I'm joined by a panel, none of whom are in studios, for obvious reasons, I should add, so bear with us, who have economic expertise and also some first-hand experience of the last major global financial shock. That was the banking crash of 2008 and 2009 and all that flowed from it. Stephanie Flanders is the head of Bloomberg Economics. She was the BBC's economics editor from 2008 to 2013. Stephanie Flanders, if you were to draw a parallel with that banking crash and now, what would it be?
You know, I think there are some similarities. The personalities and the systems in place for responding to this are going to be absolutely important, and how quickly they respond to this damage that we're seeing. The risk is that you will get this kind of negative feedback across the economy as jobs are lost and demand collapses. But I do think there are big differences. I mean, the one is it is completely global. Actually, in the financial crisis, one of the things that cushioned the blow when you're looking at it from the whole world's perspective was that China was still growing and actually quite a few emerging market economies were growing. That's obviously not the case now. It's happening everywhere. And it's also happening so quickly. I don't think we've ever had such a global and deep sudden shock to economies. But the difference, which I think, you know, if all of that makes us feel very gloomy, I think the difference is it's not centered in the financial system. There's not some very complicated issue that needs to be worked through that's going to have a long legacy if we handle it right. This didn't begin in the financial system. We've obviously seen markets falling, but it's not fundamentally coming from the financial system. We know it's coming from the way governments are having to respond to this virus. Okay. And partly for that reason, I think it shouldn't be permanent if governments do the right thing. But it's really crucial. They're going to have to spend a lot of money either way. If they spend it now, they won't necessarily be spending it in years' time because of the permanent damage.
Plenty to unpack there. Also joining us is Yanis Varoufakis, a Greek economist and politician. He's been Secretary General of DiEM25, a left-wing political party, since he founded it in 2018. He's also a former member of Syriza in Greece, and he served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. Yanis Varoufakis, how strong do you think this parallel is with the banking crash and the crisis in the Eurozone that followed?
I believe that the two are intimately connected in the sense that the 2008 crisis has never really gone away. It has morphed into a different kind of beast, which is now in a state of collapse. What happened in 2008 was a house of financial cards fell, and an entire world of illusions in Wall Street, in the City of London, in the banking systems of Europe in particular, lucrative self-deceptions and sophistries died along with it. Then that was refloated by central bank money and a majestic attempt by the Chinese government to refloat the world economy through quite incredible boosting of Chinese investment. Now, just before the coronavirus hit us, this post-2008 crisis was already pushing at least Europe and a very large part of the world capitalist economy into a period of widespread stagnation, with many trillions of dollars being in negative interest rate territory, that just being an indication that there was something rotten in the kingdom of global capitalism. And what the virus did through its simultaneous attack of the supply side of the economy and the demand side of the economy, it burst a bubble that was always going to burst, or at least to deflate. And now we have today a genuine existentialist crisis for the kind of model of the global economy that was being heralded a natural state of being. And now we have to reconsider our whole conception of the kind of world we live in.
Gosh, there's lots of big ideas being floated here. Linda Yu, you're an economist and author of The Great Economist. Is it 2008 we should be looking back to, or is there another economic shock that perhaps comes to mind?
I think we can learn some lessons from 2008 because the similarity between the current crisis and what happened 10 years ago is severity and scale. So if you compare that to, say, the previous global recessions, early 90s, early 80s, or even the dot-com bubble bursting, the early 2000s, those, of course, caused a huge amount of misery for people around the world. But the scale of what we're confronting, it looks like now, and what happened 10 years ago, is that it's such a deep-seated crisis that affects really everything from companies to banks to, you know, all of us. And I think that's why we need to look at what worked 10 years ago and try to draw some lessons from that. But one difference between this crisis and the banking crisis is that that was a banking crisis. It was an issue of the financial system, but that had a consequence which lasted really for several years, if not a decade, because once you try to repay debt and rebuild the banking system, it's a very long process. This crisis is different in that it is a health crisis. It's affected supply chains. It's affected all of us increasingly being able to go out and shop. So it's both supply and demand side, to use how economists would refer to those parts of the economy. But there isn't necessarily, if we can get the response right, that kind of very long debt repayment, slow recovery, rebuilding banks' balance sheets. We wouldn't have that necessarily as our first expectation.
Fantastic. Lots to unpick there. Véronique de Rougy is our fourth panellist, a senior research fellow at the MacArthur Centre at George Mason University in Washington, D.C. What parallels would you draw with 2008?
So first and foremost, for now, there aren't, like we had in 2008, a fundamental lack of balance and misinvestments and all sorts of distorted markets that needed to be addressed. The beginning of this recession, we also do not have high unemployment like we had in the past. It may come to this, absolutely. Also, because this is a public health issue, a lot of the traditional ways the government address supply and demand shocks may actually not work, certainly at the beginning and until we take care of this pandemic.
Fantastic. Véronique de Rougy, Linda Yu, Yanis Varoufakis, Stephanie Flanders, our panel. I'm going to introduce one more voice very briefly. By mid-October of the 2008 crash, the UK government, with Alistair Darling at the centre as Chancellor, had intervened to take HBOS, as it was called then, which is now Lloyds and RBS, into public ownership. So how does he think what happened then compares to what we will inevitably see in the coming months?
There was a fracture to the world's banking system 10 years ago, but you could see what to do. It was expensive and difficult, but it was fixed, which is why the banks are in a stronger position today than they would otherwise have been. This one is different because this pandemic is still spreading. It's not under control. We don't know how long it will last. Where there are similarities, of course, is the consequences of these things, where people lose their jobs, their income goes down, they spend less, so it affects other people as well, the cumulative effect of it. So what we do to ensure, firstly, that the economic structure, you know, the shops are there, the businesses are there when recovery comes, and also, critically, to support individuals over the next few months. That's where the similarities are, and that's where action is needed.
Some thoughts there from Alistair Darling, who was the UK Chancellor at the time of the 2008 financial crash. Something that Yanis touched on at the beginning, if I can put to you, Linda Yu, do you think that the global economy is more resilient now than it was back in 2008?
In some respects, perhaps, but I would step back and say this pandemic has hit at really still quite a vulnerable time in the global economy. We were in a cyclical global slowdown. So we have business cycles, sometimes the global economy expands, sometimes it's kind of in a slowdown phase. And we were at the part of the cycle where it looked like growth was about to stabilize. In other words, growth probably peaked in the world economy over the last 18 to 24 months. It was slowing down. And what you don't want in this part of the cycle is to have a shock that can really push the global economy into recession or worse. And that's essentially when this pandemic has hit. So looking at some of the forecasts by the think tank, the OECD, which represents a group of developed economies, they think that global growth could be halved as a result of COVID-19. And that would, and this is again very preliminary, drive global growth into what's widely considered to be a recession if global growth dips below 2.5%. And of course, some of the forecasts for advanced economies at this point, major economies, I would include China in this, also look like we are certainly recessionary, if not already in recession, as an economic activity is contracting.
So, Véronique de Rougy, you were a bit more optimistic about the fundamentals right now. Are you as pessimistic as that? Do you recognise that picture of the economy?
Well, I think the starting point is obviously very different than during the financial crisis, because we're starting with a lot of people who actually have jobs, at least here in the US. We are starting with a lot of people who have more money. It's a very different type of starting point than in 2008.
That is it said, healthier? Is it better?
I think it starts better. The question is, there's a starting point, but where does it get us? If we continue shutting down the economy like we have, if people, no matter what measure we put in place, are scared of going out and consuming, I mean, we're heading into a potentially gigantic recession with maybe fewer means to address it than we had in 2008, because it's so different.
So you've really pointed up the part where the economic meets, if you like, the medical, which is this question of continuing shutting down the economy. I want to just hang on to that thought for a second, because I want to do a bit of teaching or a bit of explaining now, which is to understand the scale of the economic problem. Yanis Varoufakis, I remember the days when you were an academic here in the UK, so I'm going to get you to do the teaching bit. Why have we seen the value of stocks tumble? And what effect do these lockdowns have on the economy from your point of view?
Imagine that there is just for this month, for the month of March, when most of Europe and much of the world economy is in lockdown. Imagine that there is just a reduction, just for that month, a reduction of 50% of economic activity, just for this month. And then the crisis supposed that it lasts only another 2 months, but you have another 25% reduction in April and another 25% minus in May. This is the best case scenario. And then recovery comes back, and by the summer, it's business as usual. Even under this fantastically optimistic, unrealistic scenario, your back of the envelope calculation would show you that we will have a recession of minus 9%. Now, anyone who is dabbling in the stock exchange will immediately sell off, because the net revenues of companies is going to collapse at the time when we have had the highest degree or proportion of indebtedness amongst corporates. 10 years of quantitative easing, 10 years of central banks printing money to meet the challenge of the 2008 crisis has given rise to zombie companies that are now not only hugely indebted, but also are facing Armageddon when it comes to demand for goods and services.
Okay.
That explains the sell-off. But what we also have, and we have seen this prevalently over the last week or so, is a fall in bond prices. Usually, when things are normal, even during bad times, when there is a reduction in share prices, the smart money rushes from equities, from shares, to buying safer government, primarily bonds. And therefore, bonds go up when shares go down. This time around, both shares and bonds have been coming down, indicating that these are extraordinary times. And I need to add this. The world economy over the last 10 years never recovered in 2008. We've never had a greater disconnect between very high liquidity, very high savings in the world economy, and very low investment relative to savings. In other words, the global economy has never been more brittle than now, and therefore the difference with 2008 is that when it comes to the fundamentals, the real economy, to the capacity of our world to take money which is available and invest it in good quality jobs and things that humanity needs, was always severely circumscribed before coronavirus hits, and now we have an existentialist crisis.
Gosh, so let's walk through this existential crisis. Stephanie Flanders, people may lose their jobs if companies can't operate, if restaurants can't run, if factories shut down. What are the consequences of that for the, obviously for the individual, it's dreadful. What are the consequences for that for the economy multiplied over hundreds of thousands?
I mean, this gets back to the policy action, and I know you want to talk more about the policy in the future, but it really does depend on how quickly governments are able to step in and, what I like to say, fill the hole. So this virus is blowing a hole, as Jana's described, into every economy. And it is like a natural event. It's like a tornado or something. And if a business gets hit by a tornado, if they've got insurance, they get compensated for all the lost business that they've had from that tornado. In effect, we all have to hope that, I mean, what the government's role is, all of our government's role, is to give us that insurance policy to compensate us. It's particularly important that businesses get compensated, because they're going to start laying people off. And then you get into that negative feedback loop that I was talking about before. You have people lose their jobs, and then you can't bounce back in a few months, because actually these companies have gone out of business that would have been perfectly fine if this health tornado hadn't hit them. But it's a very different kind of challenge. And I think that's why one other reason why investors have been nervous is that they look at governments grappling with this, wondering what to do. It's a very different thing from just the normal kind of stimulus. You know, we know it's not going to make any difference to demand for these companies, for a cafe or a restaurant, you know, to cut taxes for everybody, because we still can't leave our homes. We still can't go to those restaurants. The only thing that's going to make a difference is if governments find a good way to get money to those companies, say, look, for example, we're going to cover your pay bill for the next 2 months, or if you've had to lay people off, we're going to subsidise you to pay them at least half their salaries and keep them on the books.
And is that challenge the same everywhere?
Well, it's different if you're a government. I mean, that's why one thinks, obviously, at these times, for developing economies and economies whose governments don't have this kind of capacity and will all be hugely overwhelmed dealing with the health epidemic itself, let alone this kind of stimulus. But for the US, for the UK, for European countries, you've seen them grappling towards this in the last week, and they're on a very steep learning curve. But every day, you know, in my neighbourhood, hotels are laying people off on short-term contracts. That you can see this, you can see the bits of the economy evaporate before your eyes.
But Véronique de Rougy raised this issue of what happens if we continue with shutting down the economy. I guess governments would say there is no choice. This is a medical disaster as well, and therefore the economy has to be shut down. It's
and,
a loop.
And
it's
governments have to pay for it, but just governments have to say, don't worry, we're going to pay for it because we're causing this. We're causing it for a good reason, but we're going to pay for it.
Linda Yu, we touched on 2008, but what about the Great Depression of the 1930s then? If we're creating this loop of a lack of demand, people being laid off, companies being shut down, could we easily end up there?
That's a worrying thought. I think one of the lessons from the 1930s is that that was when it became widely accepted that government spending, if private spending wasn't happening, was necessary to get the economy on the right footing. And I think expansionary, so in other words, policies which help people, help businesses through both the government, finance ministries, as well as central banks, is the lesson to take away. So apply to today, what that suggests is there really should be three types of goals that government should think about. The first is, of course, giving the health system as much resources as it needs to make sure that first and foremost people are taken care of, because this is a health crisis. Secondly, governments need to think about how to keep people in employment. So in other words, there's a range of different measures across different governments and systems that essentially boil down to the same thing, which is if demand has fallen, what you don't want is for firms to lay people off because of this shock. What you want to do is, for instance, subsidize employers to keep employees on by essentially paying some fraction of their wage.
But all this is going to cost billions of dollars. Does it matter if governments all try to raise money at the same time?
I think in this situation, the answer is you're going to have to collectively borrow to finance it. And the thing that's important to stress is the other lesson from the 1930s is if you don't do enough, then, you know, you may recall 1937, there was actually a second recession in the 1930s. So you had a Great Depression and the economy recovered by 33. And then by 1937, there had been some pullback and then you had a second recession. But I think essentially what you have to do is think about the ways in which money is getting to the sectors that most need help. So keeping people on work, Denmark, for instance, pays 75% of people's wages. So firms only have to pay 25%. And then the final part of it is you don't want viable businesses to go under. What you want to do is to make sure companies which have cash flow problems do not end up being bankrupt. So you have to make sure there's what's called liquidity in the system. So help them with cash flow normally means that private banks need to be involved. And I think all of those things need to be done, and it's going to be done everywhere. And I think that has to be the priority. And I think if you look at what several governments have done over just the last week, I think that has become the focus. And I think that is the right focus to make sure we all get through this.
Véronique de Rougy, you were perhaps the most upbeat about all of this, but isn't there a question of how long is a piece of string? It's difficult to quantify the scale of the problem because we simply don't know how long it'll last.
Yes. I mean, I agree with the three measures. I mean, the three things that needs to happen. But I think what we need to do is not have the expectation that it will work like it works in a regular recession, because we are fundamentally in the middle of a pandemic. And as a result, these measures won't have the same effect. So lending, keeping line of credits open for companies to borrow and try to stay afloat is central. Trying to put money in people's pockets who've lost their jobs or paying paid leaves and all sorts of safety net measures are essential. But usually we do these things in hope that the economy is going to go back to normal. People are going to go back to work. People are going to start consuming now that they have money. And until we address the health scare, it's probably not going to happen.
Let's talk about solutions a little bit more in a moment. But just to remind you, you're listening to The Real Story from the BBC. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe. If you do, you'll be able to access past editions, including the discussion we had last week on whether we as individuals and members of highly complex societies are ready for the disruption that's being wrought by the coronavirus. We heard from a former big cheese at the World Health Organization, an anthropologist, an expert on the 1918 Spanish flu, and a psychologist who's looked at how we respond to health crises. Are you really willing to make sacrifices in order that your neighbour might benefit? That's last week's edition of The Real Story. But for now, we're joined by Yanis Varoufakis, Greek economist and politician, Stephanie Flanders, the head of Bloomberg Economics, Véronique de Rougy, an economist from George Mason University in Washington, D.C., and Linda Yu, an economist and author of The Great Economists. Earlier in the programme, we looked at what's happening to the economy. We tried to draw comparisons with major shocks in the past. And we began to talk about what governments can do in the face of this economic meltdown. And with almost every major economy in the world affected, it seems they're preparing to open up the coffers and borrow and spend their way through this crisis.
In these extraordinary times, our government is taking extraordinary measures. This $82 billion in support represents more than 3% of Canada's GDP.
Kenya's central bank yesterday raising limit for mobile money payments per day.
This is not a time for ideology and orthodoxy. This is a time to be bold, a time for courage. We will support jobs. We will support incomes. We will support businesses, and we will help you protect your loved ones. We will do whatever it takes.
The US Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talked of underwriting billions of dollars in loans that could be made available to companies across the country.
We're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. Many companies have now shut down, whether it's bars or restaurants. Americans need cash now, and the president wants to get cash now. And I mean now, in the next 2 weeks.
Just some of the promises that have been made in national capitals around the world. Yanis Varoufakis, I'm going to put you in charge for the next 60 seconds. If you could be in charge of the economic stimulus, what would it look like? How big would it have to be, even once the virus is under control?
It should be big enough to reassure people who are locked down and in that most of their capacity to spend over the next year is going to be replaced by the government. That means that since we heard so many times, and quite correctly, that extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures, that we should tear up the existing economic rulebook that separates fiscal from monetary policy and combine the two. So I would announce a discretionary fiscal stimulus that is very large. It is equal to the expected reduction in GDP.
So and you want governments to go on a massive spending spree?
Massive spending spree that is partly financed by direct central bank money. Central banks must stop doing quantitative easing the way they've been doing it. It has failed to even quell the stagnation prior to COVID-19. It's not going to work now, but central banks have the capacity to finance directly the government-run discretionary fiscal stimulus, including what Hong Kong did last week, what Australia did in 2009, just minting money and just putting it into people's bank accounts.
Okay, Véronique de Rougy, would you do that if you were in charge?
I think we have to be careful about what we say today we're going to do when we're out of the health crisis and things go back to normal. We will have to see what needs to be done. If this is short enough, which no one knows, it is possible that if we've done the right thing now, companies are going to be able to pick up and go, and consumers, many will not have lost their jobs and are going to start consuming. I think what we need to do is start thinking about what we do right now.
But and what right about now, putting money into people's pockets, into people's bank accounts, as the American government appears to be prepared to do?
I think we need to do this, not because we have high hopes that this will stimulate the economy, but do it as a safety net measure and also as a signal to people that we were doing something for those who are hurting.
Would you support things like statutory sick pay, which isn't available in many states in the United States?
Well, of course. I mean, right now, I think there is a role for the government to fill in the gap for workers who do not have paid leave. It needs to be targeted and temporary.
Stephanie Flanders, if I can bring you in, the role of government, it's changing, isn't it?
Well, I think it's interesting because I do think one thing, going back almost to the differences with 2008, this is one of those cases where, yes, the macro amounts are important, but it isn't about some big macro stimulus or sort of big picture policies. In each country, what's really important is going to be the micro details, and they're actually going to differ by country. So in the US, for example, they should be spending a lot on health, finding a way to get more ventilators to hospitals, because in their private system, hospitals are wondering, are we really going to spend all this money on ventilators when it's only going to last a few months? You know, that is something the government has to absolutely cut through. That's not a problem in the UK because we have the NHS, the central, their National Health Service, where you can just turn on the taps and give them as much money as they need. But what they do have a problem in the UK is you have a lot of people who are self-employed much more than 10 or 20 years ago, or low paid, 2 million people low paid who don't earn enough to qualify for that state mandated sick pay. They need to be brought into that net. Other countries will have a slightly more effective safety net for those people and will need to focus on something else. But just to go back on something that was said before, I don't have any problem as a social safety net measure to send money out to people. I want to A, make sure it's really quick. And if you're doing something for the first time, sometimes it's going to take too long to get it into people's hands. I do think also it's a little bit of reflection of failure. If you're helping people financially because they've lost their jobs, when actually you could have been giving a sort of wage guarantee to their employer, you've already missed an opportunity because that company has already maybe gone bust or has already had to massively reduce its operations.
Yanis Varoufakis, is that a sort of an ideological difference potentially, whether you give money to workers or whether you give money to prop up businesses?
If we allow ourselves to be consumed by this question, we will have failed the crucial times and the crucial challenge that we're facing. We need to throw everything. We need wage guarantees for companies, as well as money in the pockets, which is the most efficient and fastest way of substituting much of the lost spending power of people. This has to happen simultaneously. I heard some of the other panelists talk about the importance of thinking carefully about it. No, this is not a time to think. This is a time to act. And when I heard the phrase that there is a place for government, no, there's not a place for government. There's only a place for government. The private sector is running scared, both in terms of the health service and also in terms of investment, in terms of the capacity of businesses to cope with the situation. This is a time for big government to step in and to utilize all three tools at its disposal: fiscal policy, monetary policy, and the capacity of a combination of fiscal and monetary policy to replace the capacity of individuals and companies to spend money, which has simply disappeared in thin air as a result of this remarkable, extraordinary challenge.
Véronique de Rougy.
I'm sorry, but I think we do have to think about what we do because we want to have the best results. And we just don't want to be like wasting money on things that will not have any impact right now, because we may be in this for the long haul. I think that this idea that because we're in a crisis, everything goes and we need to suspend any sense of accountability or even about thinking about what is the best type of policy to do, and also just deride the private sector. I mean, it is worth noting that the U.S. health sector is in much better health than all the European countries when you look at terms of ventilator per capita, ICU beds per capita. In my opinion, if this health crisis is really as bad as people predict, it's not going to be enough. If the private sector and the public sector work together, we are more likely to have better results.
Linda, if I can bring you in, policymaking in a panic, never a great idea. And also, is there a danger that some of what's put in place in an emergency situation then becomes the new normal, which many people might not consider ideal?
There's a Ronald Reagan saying, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. I don't think there's necessarily one perfect set of policies. I think a lot of policymakers are trying to learn from other countries, adapting it to the circumstances of their own system. Obviously, some countries have weaker safety nets than other countries. America, for instance, compared with Europe. And I think there's going to be a lot of trying to get it right. But I think the most important thing is the principles the government policy needs to be geared at, which is helping people, whether they're employed or not. And I think that's one of the challenges with a lot of these systems, which is you have an increasing number of people who are self-employed, who work in the gig economy. They don't necessarily fall within the benefit system, or they don't qualify for statutory sick pay. So there's going to be a lot of people who fall between the cracks. And I think trying to work out ways to help them will be important. And I think one of the reasons why the United States, why Hong Kong are looking at sending checks directly, which to households, and it has been done before in previous recessions in the United States. It's just a very quick way of getting money into people's pockets. And I think there is some sort of retroactive means testing, which I think is probably the right time to do it through the tax system, which I think was already mentioned.
Let's just go back to Alistair Darling for a moment. And it's something that we've raised a little bit already, this idea of whether this situation we're in falls into the category of a depression, because you get a collapse in production, in supply, collapse in demand, people lose their jobs. I put that point to him.
That would only happen if governments allow it to happen. Now, there's no doubt, if you look at growth in most parts of the world, it's been pretty fragile for a long time now, so there wasn't much headroom. What we need to do, though, is to make sure, and this, only governments can do this, is to put sufficient money into the economy to mitigate the effects of all this. Recessions only become a depression, as it did in the 1930s, if government doesn't do that. Now, what is needed is in action in individual countries, but also, as we saw 10 years ago, what is critical is to get international cooperation, because these things work much, much better if confidence-boosting measures or outright support from governments is being done across the board. Now, that can sometimes be difficult, especially at the current time, but it's necessary. what is critical to my mind is that we cannot allow a situation where once we get through this pandemic, as we will at some point, that it's so fractured everything else that it takes a long, long time to get out of it. Now, that could be avoided, but it needs action, and action now.
That question of cooperation that you point to is an interesting one. Relations with China are much more frayed than they were back in 2008. We have come through a period where populism, nationalism has been rife. That sense of cooperation, even within an organisation like the EU, hasn't really been apparent, has it?
Well, I was struck 10 years ago how you had communist China, Republican-led United States, countries with huge differences, all sitting around the table, and they took action because, frankly, they were scared stiff. Now, I understand today, of course, things are different because of the tensions that you've described and, you know, the rise of nationalism, if you like, but we've got to get over that. I think no matter what people may think, whether you like it or not, we do live in an economy where we're having to deal with a virus that doesn't know international boundaries. What we need to do has got to be done by cooperating. So I think people have just got to get on with it. They've got to cooperate. They don't have any option.
But economically, wouldn't some people point to the shortcomings of globalisation as one of the underpinning factors in how countries deal with this? You know, I've got masks, I haven't got enough, I'm not going to give them to you. The vaccine's been made over there. We want it here.
Yes, you're always going to have those pressures, and you know some of them are understandable. Clearly, in the longer term, we've got to look at supply chains and so on. But I think dealing with the immediate problem we've got just now, unless all nations deal with, firstly, whatever's necessary to suppress the spread of this virus, then the cost will be immense, not just in personal terms, but to countries as a whole. Equally, if we look at the economic response required, and that will mean governments doing things they would not contemplate doing in peacetime. But we are very much on the equivalent of a war footing here. And that does mean we've got to have cooperation. I'm not saying it's easy, but if we don't have it, then the cost will be substantial.
That's Alistair Darling, who was the UK Chancellor in 2008 at the time of the financial crash. I want to pick up on that point of international cooperation. Stephanie Flanders, do you have any confidence that governments can work together now? Is there evidence that there is orchestrated action?
I think it is certainly true that the environment for international cooperation is more fragile than it was in 2008. And actually, you had a G20 meeting early on in the crisis where the US specifically, you know, other governments were starting to talk about stimulus or fiscal action to help deal with the impact of the virus. But I think the most important cooperation we've seen in the last few weeks and the most important for this crisis on the financial front is from central banks. And all the evidence suggests they are working together as they did in 2008. They're having programs where they kind of agree to lend and borrow any amount of money to each other in terms of the international swap markets. They're all doing similar things in terms of cutting their own interest rates if they can, or doing lots of bond purchases, printing of money. The most important thing and the most urgent thing is a national challenge. You know, of course, people shouldn't be putting up borders from trade or being nationalistic in the treatment of vaccine development or any of those basic things. But when it comes to supporting the economies, it is micro, it is national. It's about doing something. I mean, it is so urgent. And I think we will misspend some money if we do it right. We will end up overdoing it. That would be a much better outcome than not doing enough.
Yanis Varoufakis, you've been very critical of the way in which international cooperation, I'm going to put the word cooperation in inverted commas there, has operated in the past. Do you have any confidence that it can work this time? Or perhaps do you agree with Stephanie Flanders that it's much more about individual action in nation states?
I wish I could be confident. They are not allowing me to be confident. Look, in 2008, two things saved global capitalism from a complete collapse. On the one hand, it was the Federal Reserve and the dollar swap lines that it flooded the world markets with dollars through, and China. Overall, there was also the very splendid cooperation. The United Kingdom government at the time, and Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown, played a significant role in orchestrating this. We have none of these. China is where the virus hit first, effectively pushing the Chinese economy to its knees. We have in the White House a president that is not going to tolerate the free-flowing swap lines that the Fed made available back then. They did make some swap lines available, but at that moment, the great difference, we've talked about this before with 2008, is that we don't have a problem with liquidity. The world was flooded with liquidity, and it was already facing the problem of converting that excess liquidity into investment. Now this problem is magnified magnificently.
So lots of money going round in the system essentially already.
and not being invested. Yes, it is true, Stephanie's right, that central banks have cooperated and have opened the floodgates again, but this is now a non-gift. It's like trying to push a string from underneath, as Keynes once said. And then you have the European Union. The European Union is the largest economic bloc in the world, and it is more inane in its handling of this kind of crisis than it was even in 2010. Mm. If you look at the fiscal policy that they agreed to in the latest Eurogroup, it is a joke. It is absolutely non-existent. All they did was to accept that the fiscal rules will be probably thrown out of the window because GDP is going to collapse, but they have not tried to preempt it. Simply allowed the European Central Bank to keep flooding an already flooded market.
Véronique de Rougy, I wonder what you make of that question of relations with China and the role China played in picking up the reins back in 2008. It surely can't happen now.
It can't happen now, but that said, I think it's counterproductive for the US in particular to continue putting tariffs on essential medical equipment coming into the US just because it comes from China. There's a lot of countries that are preventing export of medical equipment. That's not cooperation. These are the kind of really counterproductive policies that countries are doing on a national basis.
What would the president, the US president, make of that then? Because, I mean, obviously he's been very concerned about the nature of globalization, and some of this protectionism has come directly as a result of his point of view.
He has, and he has been misguided from the beginning. And in the face of pretty much every economist, with the exception of the ones who are in his administration, who've actually warned him against his protectionism. Sure, I mean, globalization means that there's going to be more spread of this virus for sure. But blaming this on globalization is just nonsensical.
Well, Linda, I'm just going to bring you in. Is this the beginning of deglobalization? Is it going to speed up a process that many people wanted?
I think it's going to accelerate what's already been happening on supply chains due to technology. So what I mean is, it's already the case that, of course, certain things are produced in Asia, with China as the center. But if you look at how trade works in terms of value chains, a lot of it is regional. A lot of that is driven by a number of things, including technology, which enables things like 3D printing. It's also consumer preferences, wanting to localize supply chains. And of course, increasingly with what we've seen with the coronavirus and tensions between US and China, a feeling that supply chains may not actually be, you're going to have disruptions if it's going to be global. So I think on that sort of level, I think there's already a move to change the way that trade is done. But I suppose the bigger picture we're talking about is, if you have two economic superpowers like US and China, are you going to end up with something which is much less than a truly globally cooperative, globalized market? And I think there's a very good risk that is the tension that we're looking at. And the political tensions around COVID-19 are certainly not helping that tension.
Let's think about the economic legacy as we wrap up this hour of this crisis. What will it be? Will it be about these relationships between countries? Will there be a fundamental shift in how we run our economies? What's at the centrepiece of them? Is it the end of retailing? There's so many things. Stephanie Flanders.
Well, I think what have you been discussing about what happens to globalization? And certainly some companies have found they have super vulnerable supply chains, which they may want to rethink. That doesn't necessarily mean they bring everything home, but they certainly will want to diversify their production and think about how production goes out. I have to say, and this is partly also as we all kind of live this, I wonder whether a longer term consequence is going to be an intensification of the concerns that Yanis and others have mentioned around inequality and just how much the divide across our economies, which has become so accentuated in the way people are experiencing this crisis. You know, there is a big chunk of the population in the UK and other developed economies, including myself, who are working from home. We've got the inconvenience of having our kids with us, maybe, but our incomes aren't necessarily going to be affected. And then there's a big chunk of the population that has been terrified of schools closing and may have already lost their jobs, is not well served by the welfare system, and may also find in many countries that they're not going to get the kind of healthcare that they need as easily as their more well-off neighbours. And I just wonder, the fact that this is so coming home to roost, some of these divides, even for people who politically weren't focused on these issues. I just wonder whether it'll become much more salient even than it was before.
Véronique de Rougy, I wonder if what you make of that, and also whether you think if there are bigger social safety net is rolled out, whether that could end up being the lasting legacy.
I think it could end up being a lasting legacy, but I'm not sure it will. I think one of the uplifting things that we're seeing right now is the willingness of a lot of people, that includes me, who are not in favor, usually in normal times, to have the federal government rather than the private sector extend paid leave, or the extension of a lot of safety net program above and beyond people who truly need it, like we've seen in the U.S. Everyone I read right now is acknowledging that this is a really different time and that the government needs to step in to fill in these gaps, because people recognize that not everyone is facing this crisis the same way. And I think it ought to be recognized that what's important is that in time of crisis, people will put away their ideological differences and be willing to do a lot of things that they wouldn't otherwise. What I hope is that we do what is right and everyone puts their ideology aside during this crisis. And then we deal with the aftermath, recognizing that there are different responses that we need to apply depending on the time we're in.
Yanis Varoufakis, what do you think will be the lasting economic legacy?
You mentioned the possibility that the measures that will be taken will constitute the new normal. I believe that the legacy of this crisis is going to be the end of normal, in the same way that the Great Depression, the Second World War, created new concepts and new institutions, from the National Health Service in Britain to the Great Society in the United States. I believe that the legacy is going to be the end of over-reliance on monetary policy, with fiscal policy playing almost no role over the last decades, and the institution as more or less a bipartisan idea of a kind of universal basic income.
Linda Yu, that's a big idea there, which sadly we haven't got time to explore, but I wonder what you think might be the lasting economic legacy.
I think across all countries, there will be a re-examination of the social safety net to some extent. And the reason I say that is because the gig economy and changes because of the way that e-commerce technology has changed the way that we consume and produce, the growth of that sector is going to require another look at the ways in which those people can be supported during a crisis. So what I think one of the legacies will be from this is ensuring that, you know, all members of society are captured somehow within a social safety net, which of course vary between countries. And I think the second thing I would stress is the renewed use of fiscal policy, by which I mean government spending, government investment. I think that is going to be bolstered if governments do what they need to in this crisis, seeing the effectiveness of that. I think it's going to begin to change the way we think about the role of government in terms of, for instance, investing to help boost growth in the future. And that goes to Yanis's point that fiscal policy is going to become viewed as more important than it has been perhaps for a number of years. And then I guess finally, I think the economic legacy from this crisis is going to be that we never know where the next crisis will come from. So we looked at 2008, and rightly so. But I think if you were to ask most people whether or not 2020 would have a coronavirus COVID-19 crisis, and that was going to lead to a big shock to the global economy, I think the lesson there is never think you can expect to predict the next crisis, but you must make your systems resilient, both privately and publicly, to cope with whatever might come down along the way, the best you can.
We will have to see what comes to pass. We ought to reunite you in a few months' time to see where we've arrived. Linda Yu, thank you very much. Also Yanis Varoufakis, Stephanie Flanders and Véronique de Rougy. Thank you all very much for joining us. From me, Rithula Shah, and the whole team, that's The Real Story for this week. Thank you for listening. Wash your hands and do listen again next time.